Greetings, welcome, bienvenidos, hola, aloha, ni hao, namaste, konnichiwa, bonjour, buongiorno, sawadee karup, guten tag, ciao, we viva, cat bang, half a day, jai janendra, salam, shalom, peace, now, go vegan, peace how, go vegan. From the left coast of the unlabeled, genetically mutated McNugget pharmaceutical kill, vivisection prison, killitary industrial corporation, in the cheese-covered, post-constitutional, bankster bankrupt, corruptocracy, mocracy, criminocracy of the United States of Listeria, foodborne in the NSA, NRA, USA, home of Uncle Sam, Manila, where they sure do eat a lot of dead animal body parts. And the Wall Street-backed corporate diet of death, disease, and destruction is shoved down your throat. This is Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. At that time of year, yes, the kids are already bored with all those new toys, never to be found again, except in some beached whale's stomach in a couple of years. Meanwhile, the kids remain fascinated mainly by the boxes in which those toys came. So, there you go. I wrote a poem on Christmas Eve, which you can read on my Facebook socialist media pages, inspired by a butcher's website that was celebrating the holidays, as only a butcher's website would. And so I wrote a vegan Christmas poem for the animals. I won't read it. I won't read it now. I would have to get over my fear of public speaking, although Daisy obviously has no fear of public speaking. And my fear of public speaking actually in iambic pentameter. So we'll see. If I run out of material, maybe we'll get to the poem. If not, go to goveganradio.com or one of the Bob Linden pages, or the Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden Facebook page. Anyway, you know, so, I mean, if Robert Frost can have his classic with a speciesist reference to, you know, horse enslavement, you know, so I can do mine for the animals, huh? As the clock ticks and tucks toward the new year, this show started in January of 2001. So I think it's about time for a bathroom break, don't you think? No. Holy cow. So next month, this show is 14 years old. 14 years old. We'll be broadcasting in our 15th year. Well, this is the time of year when all of those nonprofit organizations tell you all the good things they did, so you'll give them money now. You know, 501c3, Go Vegan Radio is now completing its 14th year broadcasting a vegan message in mainstream media. Go Vegan Radio, as heard on the Air America Radio Network, as heard on CBS and Clear Channel radio stations, now syndicated by the Genesis Communications Network, and heard live Sundays, 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Does that not earn your donation? Huh? Every week, a vegan radio program. Isn't that worth it, huh? A vegan radio show that is also organizing the World Vegan Summit and Expo. Go to worldvegansummit.com. You'll see the work that we're doing. Is that not worth it? I ask you. Or will the vegans instead donate once again to the Humane Society of the United States, or 350.org, or the Sierra Club? You know, vegans really need to divest from HSUS and 350.org and the Sierra Club. This is the time of year when they're also telling you what they did, you know, this year, so that you'll send them some cash, send some cash their way, even if they have to lie to do it, huh? But if you purport to represent the interest of animals, or you purport to represent the interest of the planet and the environment, well, then rancher donations require advanced deception techniques, you know, protecting, you know, actually, well, perfecting the ability to lie with a straight face. No giggling, you know, and to lie without glancing away or looking down, you know, feeling guilty about that, takes a lot of practice, a lot of dedication, and acting skills. For example, right now, the Humane Society of the United States is using the phrase restorative beef. Restorative beef, huh? Now, how many hours does a Wayne Pacelle lie have to stand in front of a mirror without laughing, you know? I mean, without being hysterical before he can say that, you know, with a straight face. Yes, restorative beef. I can't say it with a straight face yet. I've been practicing for a little while. I have to practice more. Probably the same amount of time, you know, for practice, it took Fibbin Bill McKibben to say sustainable meat. And so we get this parade of liars. Oh, I know, it's not polite to say that people lie or to call them liars. They're supposed to say, you know, we get this parade of people not telling the truth. You know, who all give, I don't know, I get a bit of a sick feeling whenever I see them. You know, whether it's George W. Bush or Wayne Pacelle Lie, Cheney or Fibbin Bill McKibben or Obama. I mean, you do have to admire their dedication to the lie and their dedication to the money that motivates the lie, the willingness to sacrifice countless lives to torture and to death, to sacrifice the very planet, you know? So if Obama ever does have to fire, you know, CIA officials over lying about torture, well, I think Wayne Pacelle Lie is the perfect candidate for the job, don't you think? And in a sense, Wayne Pacelle Lie is already CIA, in this sense, chicken industry ally, CIA. It takes a talented agent to rationalize torture, whether you are CIA or CIA, Wayne Pacelle Lie, CIA chicken industry ally, rationalize torture again, right, for the end of the year, with you know, these claims that something good is about to happen for chickens with the new year, as Prop 2 comes in, huh? Who appointed these people, huh? People who determine what acceptable torture is. Who appointed them? People like Wayne Pacelle Lie tell us that 67 square inches of space are acceptable. That's acceptable torture. It's always lose-lose for the animals, you know, when HSUS is involved. I mean, it's HSUS is selling us the cruelty of modified cages. I mean, first of all, does anybody really know what Prop 2 is and what it's supposed to do? Nobody knows. Nobody knows, really. I mean, back when that was the major campaign of so-called animal advocates at the time. So Paul Shapiro of HSUS, now that's a prize job to be, you know, the vice president of animal protection at a rancher advocacy organization. What a job. Impossible job. And Paul Shapiro handles it just, you know, like the impossible job it is. So he and I were still talking at the time some years back, and he was telling me that what Prop 2 would do is enlarge the space that hens got from the current 8.5 inches by 11 inches to 12 inches by 12 inches. So that's what Paul Shapiro was telling me at the time. I didn't realize it. Wayne Pacelle Lie was selling the lie across the state that California would become a cage-free state because of Proposition 2. So Shapiro has it going 8.5 by 11 to 12 by 12. Pacelli has the state going cage free, and then other advocates were going around saying, "Oh, this has nothing to do with veganism or vegetarianism. It's can't we please get the birds, you know, space to spread their wings, just to spread their wings?" And it turns out that it would have to be one bird at a time. Given the space that the birds have, I know that. I hope they know, you know, how to, you know, just take turns to do it. But it really turns out to be one bird at a time, and so these modified cages, the furnished cages or enriched cages, they're all battery cages. They were opposed by HSUS and all of its groupie groups until they decided that they would campaign for them during the egg bill. So now what we have is what used to be totally unacceptably cruel to all of these groups being used by J.S. West and Company in California, the modified cage, as proposition to compliant. And HSUS now praises J.S. West and these modified battery cages, which were unacceptable in the past, as Wayne Pacelli comes back to California and now tells us that the spirit of Prop 2 is cage-free, and that you know, retailers who sell eggs in California should all go cage-free. So basically what you get from HSUS is lose-lose for the chickens, because these cages are losers for the chickens. And cage-free, if you don't know it, total loser for the chickens. It's basically a cage, you know, with tens of thousands of birds massed together. Anyway, we will continue. It's Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. Coming up, we will also be talking about the Sierra Club and 350.org today with Mike Hudak and Leslie Goldberg. Next hour, animal rights commentary with Professor Gary Francione on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden at goveganradio.com. Continue on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden at GoVeganRadio.com, on Twitter at Go Vegan Radio, Facebook, Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. There are also a couple of Bob Linden pages on Facebook where you can find my vegan Christmas poem for the animals. I won't torture you by reading it here now, but you can find it there. On this program, a little bit later on, you know, it's just we're exposing these supposed animal advocacy groups, you know, and environmental groups. Today we will be exposing the Sierra Club, 350.org, and Fibbin Bill McKibben, coming up in just a few moments. As if you can be a meat-eating environmentalist, right, or a proponent for meat and consider yourself an environmentalist. Meat, dairy, fish, and eggs. That's the insanity of it all. Is it any wonder that we need a World Vegan Summit and Expo to kind of straighten things out and focus ourselves on what's really important, which is helping everybody go vegan, you know, not to eat humane meat, so-called humane meat. Like HSUS, I mean, HSUS is just bragging about what it's done this year. Look at the HSUS list, right? Right now, Prop 2 is coming into effect. Lose-lose for the chickens for forever. HSUS also promoted Hoofin' It this year in Denver. Four nights, a slaughter fest. Four consecutive nights of eating animals, hoofed animals. That was the cleverness of that promotion. In the California shelters, HSUS proposed no waiting time for the guardians of cats to come and see if their cats are at the shelter. Just kill them immediately. And also HSUS proposed that dogs and cats in California shelters should be sold to business enterprises that might conduct animal research on them. That's HSUS, your animal advocacy at work for you, along with giving millions of dollars of your donations to Ringling Brothers, HSUS, and that clown Wayne Pacell out giving millions to Ringling Brothers because of its implications in RICO and racketeering and, you know, just that's the animal rights movement there. And the vegan movement will be at the Marriott Marina Del Rey, March 20, 21, and 22 of 2015. You can register now. Go to that website, worldvegansummit.com. You'll see it is an amazing event with incredible activities. Look at all the speakers there. I mean, I just was in touch with Dr. Michael Clapper last week, and he got in touch with me. He said, am I still on for the World Vegan Summit and Expo? We haven't discussed this in a while. I said, yeah. I mean, look at the website. He looked at the website, and he made sure that he's going to be there now for a few days. You know, he said, wow, I got to be there. Look, this is incredible. And you need to be there, too. And, you know, we need to really focus our attention on what's important. That's helping people to go vegan because it is the only way to save the planet from climate change. You won't hear that from the Sierra Club or 350.org, but we'll be getting into that in just a little bit. And I do want to thank Vegetarian House for helping to get things started. Vegetarian House, 100% vegan restaurant in San Jose, for helping us kind of, you know, ignite things so that we were able to get the deposit to give to the Marriott so we could get things rolling. And I want you to go to vegetarianhouse.us. If you are in the San Francisco Bay Area, treat yourself. Go to one of the best vegan restaurants in the world. It's 100% vegan, organic, no GMOs. And Vegetarian House caters. So if you have an event coming up in the Bay Area, a business event, social event, if you're getting married, Vegetarian House is catering a lot of weddings now, just, you know, to make sure things get started on the right foot, you know. So it's vegetarianhouse.us, vegetarianhouse.us. And also you'll see that for vegan-oriented businesses, there's the opportunity to have vegan, your exhibitor table at the World Vegan Summit and Expo. So all of that information is there at worldvegansummit.com, worldvegansummit.com, and you'll be able to meet Green Light Meals at the summit. GreenLiteMeals.com. Check it out. Home delivery of vegan food wherever you are in the USA. GreenLiteMeals.com. We'll continue. It's Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. GoVeganRadio.com. Dr. Mike Hudak coming up to talk about the Sierra Club and its new agricultural policies on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden at GoVeganRadio.com. Radio with Bob Linden at GoVeganRadio.com, on Twitter at GoVeganRadio, and Facebook, GoVeganRadio with Bob Linden, a couple of Bob Linden pages on Facebook also. And I invite you to support this program with a tax-deductible donation. You can click donate at GoVeganRadio.com. And also, please register now for the World Vegan Summit and Expo. That's WorldVeganSummit.com. Well, Mike Hudak, PhD, has been a guest on our program in the past. We'll be joined by Leslie Goldberg in a little bit. She is the vicious vegan blogger. And Mike has been on our program as author of Western Turf Wars, The Politics of Public Lands Ranching. He is also the former chair of the Sierra Club's grazing team. Now, I went back to New York City. I got a new half-mile range megaphone for the event, for the People's Climate March. I had a sense that there would be nobody there talking about animal agriculture, since nobody in the environmental movement seems to talk about animal agriculture. So I thought, well, maybe I'd get a chance with a few seconds as 400,000 people went by. I would say something like, you know, hey, by the way, animal agriculture is the number one cause of climate change, etc. Mike, you were there in New York City also. Why did you decide to write an article about last September's climate march?
Yeah, well, Bob, yes, I was asked by a friend, Adam Weissman in particular, who runs an organization called Global Justice for Animals and the Environment, and he was writing a critique about the march, and he specifically wanted me to comment about the march organizers avoiding mention of animal agriculture's contribution to human-induced greenhouse gases. Now, we know that even a conservative body like the UN acknowledges that about 14.5% of these gases come from animal agriculture. World Watch Institute puts the amount at more than half. But even at 14.5%, it's still more than the greenhouse gas emissions from all forms of transportation. So it's not something to be discounted. But the march organizers were silent about animal agriculture, even to the extent of the choice of the food vendors at the march. And yes, there were plant-based food options available, but there was also food containing beef, dairy products, even shrimp, most likely farm-raised shrimp, which has a much greater greenhouse gas contribution than shrimp harvested from the open sea. Anyway, production of all these foods results in significant amounts of atmospheric carbon, either as carbon dioxide or methane. And so with their silence, march organizers missed a tremendous opportunity to educate the public about animal agriculture's role in worsening climate change. And that was the lead-in for me then to start looking at some of the organizations involved in organizing the march.
I'm so happy I never made it over to the food trucks. I never saw that. That would have, you know, my head would have exploded even more. I was just tired after my 4 hours on the megaphone. So Daisy and I just went walking through Central Park there. You know, so what can you say about why march organizers ignored animal agriculture? Why?
Yeah. Well, let me tell you what I found out as I looked into this a little bit more. I looked especially at the primary march organizer, which is Bill McKibben's organization, 350.org. And in looking at that, I learned that Tom Steyer, a billionaire former hedge fund manager and currently a rancher, has reportedly donated millions of dollars to 350.org and other climate change organizations like that. And that's interesting because although 350.org hasn't taken a position on animal agriculture's role in climate change, that organization's founder and leader, Bill McKibben, has taken a positive position on animal agriculture, both verbally and in print. And for example, in 2010, McKibben wrote an article in Orion magazine called The Only Way to Have a Cow, in which he promoted the use of grass-fed cattle as a way of sequestering atmospheric carbon in the soil and reducing greenhouse gases. And this is exactly the line that Alan Savory uses to promote his style of grazing that he calls holistic management. And this style, for our listeners who might not know what holistic management means, it's basically a way of managing cattle in an intensive way, heavy grazing, rotational, and that means that the livestock graze an area intensely and then they're moved to another area, and the process is repeated several times, and there's typically a considerable duration that elapses before the animals would again graze on the initial plot, and then the whole process is repeated in some way. Well, It has since come to light that people associated with Alan Savory's organization, the Savory Institute, worked with Bill McKibben in his writing of that Orion article in 2010. Then we see that in connection with McKibben's promotion of grazing to sequester atmospheric carbon, and I'll note that the Savory Institute cites research showing that soil from a landscape that's been continuously heavily grazed contains less carbon than a landscape that's been rotationally grazed, sort of the Alan Savory holistic management style. But that research also shows that the rotationally grazed area has been light or moderately grazed. But what the website doesn't show, this is the Savory website, what it doesn't show is that the same research also shows that soil from an ungrazed landscape contains just as much carbon as the rotationally grazed one, and without the cattle. So here's the point. You know, there's no additional carbon emitted as methane from enteric fermentation, or as you might call it, burping cows. Well, okay, back to Bill McKibben. His Orion article of almost 5 years ago hasn't been the only place that he's been promoting these views consistent with holistic management. He's also promoted them on his speaking tours, specifically the Do the Math tour that he did a few years ago, even as recently as last year, which are done, have been done under the auspices of 350.org. And we know what McKibben has said on that tour, at least at one stop in Australia last year, because Paul Mahoney, an animal and climate activist who was present, has blogged about it. So we have a positive connection there between Bill McKibben and Alan Savory, even to the extent of Bill McKibben basically working with people at the Savory Institute to write that article. And then he said the same kinds of things on his speaking tours. But what about a connection between Tom Steyer and Alan Savory? Well, it turns out that Steyer, as a rancher, is a big proponent of holistic management, and he even uses it on his ranch in California. And even more than that, he's even had Alan Savory come to his ranch conduct a public workshop about it. So, you see, this is something that Tom Steyer seems to really be into. Now, one thing that we have to consider, well, maybe holistic management is just the greatest grazing management style out there. Well, maybe not. There's a considerable body of published research in scientific journals stretching back more than 30 years that show that holistic management is typically no better than any other form of livestock grazing management in important ways, and that holistic management actually can be destructive, especially in arid environments such as the American West and Southwest. It can do things like reduce water infiltration into the soil. It can increase erosion. It can reduce forage production. It can reduce mineral cycling. And all of that can be bad for the vegetation in various ways. And if it's bad for the vegetation, it's going to be bad for the free-living animals that depend on that vegetation. And so the bad effects can just ripple out and out through the various populations of various species of animals. And I would say that I would have hoped that Bill McKibben, rather than simply letting himself be spoon-fed talking points by people from Alan Savory's organization, would have checked their claims in the scientific literature where he'd have found the sorts of concerns that I've just mentioned. Now, of course, I don't know that he didn't do that. Perhaps we should just simply take into consideration that Tom Steyer, being a proponent of this type of grazing management and a major contributor to 350.org, is the sort of person that the leader of that organization would just want to please. Now, if your listeners want to read more about what I found out about all of this with 350.org and Tom Steyer, I would say that they can find my essay pretty easily on the web just by doing a browser search on my name, Mike Hudak, and the phrase Climate March.
Okay, and Mike, H-U-D-A-K, and the phrase Climate March, and it's amazing what you're saying. Now, it's interesting. I tend to lean toward the World Bank and World Watch Institute figures of animal agriculture producing at least 51% of all greenhouse gas emissions. I looked at its study of the initial UN report that estimated 18% and what the climate specialist at the World Bank thought about that. But Bill McKibben said the World Bank report has been discredited, but he won't say by whom. So
yeah, that's right.
Right? That's another question for him.
That's right. And what Mahoney has mentioned about McKibben's presentation in Australia, that McKibben didn't give any references for his statements. In fact, I would also encourage people, if they want a real full account of what Bill McKibben said in Australia on that tour, to do a browser search on Paul Mahoney's blog, and just do a search on the phrase Paul Mahoney, M-A-H-O-N-Y, and Bill McKibben, for instance, and I'm sure that Mahoney's blog will come up. He has an extremely detailed analysis of Alan Savory's holistic management and Bill McKibben's remarks.
Mm. And, you know, also Savory, the Savory Institute, and the Humane Society of the United States or Humane Society International are all part of a worldwide global alliance to meet the demands of a 50% increase in, demand for livestock products. You know, so 70% demand increase by 2050. So, you know, you need someone like McKibben to say it's good for the environment. You need someone like HSUS to say it's sustainable. And here's, it's time for our break already. So we'll continue with Mike Hudak. This is very interesting. Rancher money affecting the policies of our top environmental groups. We'll also be joined by Leslie Goldberg, Gary Francione next hour on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden at goveganradio.com. We continue on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden at GoVeganRadio.com, Twitter at GoVeganRadio, Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden on Facebook. So, pretty shocking so far. We've been talking to Mike Hudak, PhD, who is the author of Western Turf Wars, The Politics of Public Lands Ranching, but he's also the former chair of the Sierra Club's grazing team. If you missed any of our interview, very shocking so far. Rancher money influencing 350.org. What do you think about that? But on to the Sierra Club. So, Mike, the Sierra Club has recently been revising its policy on animal agriculture. What are your concerns about that?
Well, here's the situation. Early this year, the Sierra Club established a task force to examine its agriculture policy, which hasn't been updated since 1976. Now, I personally don't know the club volunteers on the task force, but I can tell you that one of them is a dairy farmer, and another is the spouse of someone who's expressed support for Alan Savory's holistic management. So I just mentioned that to suggest that there's people on there who like animal agriculture.
Oh, I thought Cowspiracy, you know, kind of inspired a new look at animal agriculture. Maybe not. Maybe I'm not thinking.
Yeah. Well, one would hope. But yeah. In that regard, you know, the staff person on the task force is Bruce Hamilton. You know, who everyone who's seen the documentary Cowspiracy might recall from the opening scene, where Hamilton is talking about various factors that contribute to global climate change, and then the filmmaker asks, well, what about animal agriculture? And Hamilton replies, oh, well, what about it?
I remember.
yeah. Well, okay. So anyway, the task force presented its draft revised ag policy to the club's national board at the end of October. And the board then approved the policy, the draft policy, to be released to the club's membership for a 60-day comment period. So that's the first really that anyone outside of the task force and the board got to see this thing. Now, there are many problems with this proposed policy, and I hope that your other guest, Leslie, will point out as many as she has time for. But I want to focus on just one aspect of that policy, a topic that I've been involved with in the Sierra Club since 1998, and that's the ranching that occurs on federal public lands. So just to give you and our listeners a little of my history with that, I'll say that back in 1998, I was greatly disappointed to discover that the club's policy on ranching merely advocates for better management rather than for ranching's removal from public lands. And so I devoted 2 years to building support within the Sierra Club to strengthen that policy. And I gave presentations across the United States in 20 states. I attended 3 national board meetings at club headquarters in San Francisco. And at the last such meeting in September 2000, I was at the negotiating table with Bruce Hamilton and other club members to finalize details of a new policy, which a couple days later was approved by the club's board of directors. So for me, the best part of that policy is the provision stating that, and I'm going to just read this, I'm quoting, commercial grazing is not appropriate on federal public lands except where it is shown by science that some grazing is needed to achieve ecological objectives, unquote. Now, I have to tell you, I didn't like the qualification of opposition to grazing in this statement, but I was told that it was intended to apply in only a few unusual situations, and I knew what those
situations
were.
Sounds like to apply to Alan Savory or something,
well,
right?
No, it's a little trickier than that, actually. If that hadn't been in there, it potentially could have put the club into opposing the application of management for some species that are listed on the Federal Endangered Species Act, which require some disturbance of the landscape in order to survive. And these are some insects, by the way. And normally the disturbance would be in the form of natural fire, but because these areas have now been encroached upon by suburban development, they can't do the fire, and so they bring cattle in to disturb the landscape. It's a very unusual situation. But nevertheless, I agreed to this. I have to say, though, that at least in the 14 years since the policy has been in place, including 5 years that I spent as chair of the club's grazing committee, that I had not seen this exception abused. So that's the good news, anyway.
Okay, we're up against the break, so we'll have to continue. Okay, so we'll have Mike Hudak and also vicious vegan blogger Leslie Goldberg, who actually confronted both Bill McKibben and Michael Bruhn of the Sierra Club. We'll hear about that on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden coming up. Greetings and welcome to the second hour of Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. We're live Sundays, 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also click Listen Live at GoVeganRadio.com, where the programs are archived. You can click Donate, and you can also see some of the links there. By the way, before you make that toast to the new year, you should realize that all wines are not vegan and certainly not organic. There is a link at GoVeganRadio.com to make sure that you can find vegan wines that are organic. And also, if you look around, you'll find SoCal CSA. Click on that. You can actually have veganic produce delivered to your home or office in the Southern California area. This is so exciting. We're going to be eating veganic food from Freckled Sunlight Farms, and they're the ones behind the SoCal CSA, the banner ad at GoVeganRadio.com. Very exciting World Vegan Summit and Expo. Look at the menu at WorldVeganSummit.com, and we'll be eating veganic produce there. So, check it out. Register there at the site. So today it is Sierra Club Exposed. Fibbin Bill McKibben Exposed. 350.org Exposed.
one of those who exposing them today, Mike Hudak, PhD, author of Western Turf Wars, The Politics of Public Lands Ranching. You can... He has a couple of archives at GoVeganRadio.com. He was also the former chair of the Sierra Club's grazing team, and now the Sierra Club has recently been revising its policy on animal agriculture. But, Mike, you are concerned.
Yes, I am. And I was, as I was saying before the break, the policy on grazing that we negotiated back in 2000 it actually has a pretty... a firm stance against grazing on public lands, at least to the extent that it puts the burden of proof on anyone who wants to justify grazing on public lands. It doesn't put the burden of proof on people like us who don't want the grazing there. So with that said, let's take a look at this new agriculture policy that is now under consideration. And a statement in that, and I'm going to quote here, says... Properly managed livestock grazing can be an appropriate activity on many public lands which are suitable for sustained yield forage production, unquote. Now, if this provision is adopted as part of that policy, it will significantly weaken the club's grazing policy. And here's why. By stating that livestock grazing can be an appropriate activity on many public lands, the implication is that livestock grazing can be appropriate on any public land, with the burden of proof now on ranching opponents as to where it might not be appropriate. So
this represents a reversal in policy then, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Suddenly it's a...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing, but there's more.
For the worse. we're saying a reversal impulse.
Well, if that weren't bad enough, Bob.
Yeah.
On the comment page, there's a web form that the club has set up for members to submit comments about this proposed policy. And on that page, there's a link to a one-page summary about this new ag policy. And that summary includes what I regard as a misleading statement about the language that I just read to you. And specifically, that one-page summary states, quote, the existing public lands grazing policy would be unchanged, unquote. What? You know? I mean, I don't think one needs a law degree to recognize that when a governing body, like the Sierra Club, for instance, has two conflicting statements about an issue, that the more recent one is going to take precedence. And that's why it's obvious to me that this language in the agriculture policy would change and weaken the grazing policy. So this brings us back to the question of what's going on in the Sierra Club. Why the effort now to weaken its grazing policy that's been in effect for 14 years? What's the ecological justification? You know, it seems to make no sense. But I wonder if there isn't a parallel here with the situation that I mentioned earlier about 350.org and Bill McKibben and donor rancher Tom Steyer. For example, Sierra Club director Michael Bruhn has recently acknowledged that Tom Steyer donates to the Sierra Club. Now, we don't know how much he donates, but I suspect it's a fair amount. I mean, Steyer is a guy that put something like $74 million of his money into the last election in November, trying to influence elections. Well, okay, fine. But I suspect he gives a considerable amount to the Sierra Club. And something that I suspect our listeners don't really know about the Sierra Club and large donors is that, you know, while the club solicits annual memberships from, you know, little people like us, and there's about 600,000 such people who pay annual dues nowadays, but in recent years, the combined dues of these people has accounted for only about 14 to 16% of the club's income. And last year, 74% of the club's income came from gifts and grants from foundations associated with people like Michael Bloomberg, for instance, who in 2011 made a $50 million donation to the club's Beyond Coal campaign. And we know Steyer has a foundation as well that he's doled out money to 350.org to. So presumably there's money coming out of that to the Sierra Club as well. Hmm. And we also know that the Sierra Club's recent history has been clouded with a large contribution, an anonymous one, that has influenced club policy for the worse. And it doesn't have anything to do with food, but it's just an example of how a large anonymous donation can influence club policy. And in that regards, a large $26 million donation that the Sierra Club in 2007 took from Chesapeake Energy Company, which is currently the second largest natural gas producer in the United States, and a company that produces much of that gas through hydraulic fracturing, which is sometimes commonly called fracking. And that money, by the way, was earmarked for the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign, which seeks to close coal-fired power plants and to prevent new ones from being approved. Well, for several years, from 2007 on, the Sierra Club members who wanted to oppose fracking in the name of the Sierra Club here in New York State and elsewhere for that matter were prevented from doing so by the Sierra Club. Instead, the club was touting the gas industry propaganda about natural gas being a bridge fuel between coal and renewables like wind and solar. And then finally, in February of 2012, Time magazine broke the story about this $26 million donation from this gas company. And the club did a 180-degree turnabout, albeit slowly, and then went on finally to develop a Beyond Natural Gas campaign. But it took the club until October of this year to decide that it would allow its chapters to oppose fracking. And meanwhile, activists associated with many other organizations had been petitioning New York State government for 6 years to ban fracking, which the governor finally did just a couple weeks ago. So my point in telling this story is to show that there's at least one recent example of the Sierra Club having taken a weak position on an issue because it didn't want to offend a donor, which the club hoped would provide additional funding. So I have to wonder, you know, if there's an anonymous donor out there today, maybe Tom Steyer, who has ranching interests, or someone like him, or in addition to him, who the club is seeking to satisfy by promoting grazing in this agriculture policy, just like they were doing a few years ago by promoting natural gas.
Hmm. Pro-grazing. Pro-grazing environmentalists. Pro-grazing meat-eating environmentalists. Wow, what a group. pretty amazing. And what's really upsetting to me, though, is that they seem to want to misrepresent this to the membership. How can members not be confused by what's being said here, too, right?
I mean, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Well, so, I mean, can anything be done to voice opposition to, I mean, the weakening of the grazing policy with the Sierra Club?
Well, sure. The comment period on this proposed agriculture policy is open until mid-January, and I'm sure that there will be many complaints lodged by club members. When the comment period ends, the club's agriculture task force is then supposed to consider these comments about the policy, make modifications, and then bring a revised policy back to the board of directors for their consideration. If this issue about the grazing that I've raised is not corrected by then, I'm sure that some directors will object, but if they're outvoted, then the club will end up with a weakened grazing policy. Beyond that, there wouldn't be anything further that could be done within the club's administrative framework to revise the policy in the near future. It would be basically a done deal. But if that unfortunate situation comes to pass and the Sierra Club becomes a propaganda machine for ranchers in the way that it was a few years ago for frackers, I'm putting club leaders on notice that the ensuing criticism will be relentless, not just a few unflattering articles in the L.A. Times or Harper's or wherever that might blow over in a week or two. I'm talking about activists shadowing club leaders like Michael Bruhn when they make public appearances and then asking them why the club has thrown in its lot with ranchers. And then, of course, to get those interactions on video and uploaded to the web. And beyond that, if simply asking questions isn't sufficient to embarrass these guys and gain considerable publicity, yeah, I'd additionally recommend the kind of direct actions that have been carried out at Chipotle restaurants over the last year. But with those actions, of course, made relevant to ranching and the Sierra Club. Now, I hope it doesn't come to that, but the choice is up to the club leaders.
So it almost seems like you talk about this guy Bruce Hamilton there. It's like, does he know, has he heard of Cowspiracy? I mean, it's almost like it didn't happen here, you know? I mean,
oh, yeah.
It's really, I mean, you would expect there to be a reaction that would address animal agriculture in the opposite way from what's happening now. And I also see that he blogged and he said, you know, he seemed to recommend that, you know, nobody's saying don't eat meat. He's saying eat grass-fed beef. I don't know. It's very, very
That's
strange.
Right. Yeah. Well, he wrote that, unless he's updated the blog very recently, he wrote that shortly after Cowspiracy came out, but before the draft ag policy was released at the end of October. So I think he was basically saying, well, wait and see what's in the draft ag policy. So he seemed to act like he thought this draft ag policy was going to address those issues.
Not quite. We need to take a break, Mike Hudak. And Leslie Goldberg will come on Vicious Vegan, who she is, coming up next. It's Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden at GoVeganRadio.com, Twitter at GoVeganRadio, Facebook Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, and World Vegan Summit and Expo coming up. We'll be waking up having Select Organic Coffee and Tea, S-E-E-L-E-C-T. We'll be waking up to that at the World Vegan Summit and Expo. And you can register now at worldvegansummit.com. We've been talking to Mike Hudak, and corruption is so fascinating that we've left little time to talk to Leslie Goldberg. So I hope we'll make the most of a few minutes and then invite you back next week. But Leslie's been an award-winning investigative reporter for the San Francisco Examiner, Pulitzer Prize nominee, no less, known for her blog Vicious Vegan. She is a lifelong member of the Sierra Club and very willing to challenge the policies and the powers that be. She's actually confronted both Michael Brune and Bill McKibben. And how are you, Leslie?
I'm very well. Thank you.
Thanks for being with us here today. So pretty interesting conversation with Dr. Hudak there, I thought.
Really? Really, yeah. Incredible.
Yeah, this is it's so amazing, you know, and only, you know, the planet is at stake, you know, the way I always thought HSUS was like this, but it's the environmental movement too. So so I see, Leslie, that on your blog Vicious Vegan, I read that so you confronted both I call him Fib and Bill McKibben of 350.org and Michael Brune of the Sierra Club regarding animal agriculture and the environment, and seems like a fair question for you to address there. So tell us a little of what happened, and you know, we'll see how much we can discuss today and part two next week if we have to.
Okay. In 2012, I went to an environmental conference in Northern California called Bioneers. I don't know if you've heard of it, but it's a big environmental weekend conference, mostly about sustainable agriculture. They really like grass-fed beef and backyard chickens, et cetera, et cetera.
That drives me crazy. It drives, the grass-fed, well, because methane, it's supposed to be at least, you know, up to 400% more methane produced through grass-fed, you know, anyway.
Exactly, and it was really depressing for me because nobody there was talking about the huge amount of greenhouse gas caused by livestock. Nobody was talking about the monumental water pollution, the water waste caused by livestock production. Nobody was talking about the huge habitat loss and the deforestation caused by livestock. And nobody was talking about the imperative need to either stop eating animal foods or seriously cut back.
And this was an environmental conference, huh?
This was, yeah, exactly. And after about a day and a half of this, Bill McKibben took the stage to give his lecture. And I was really excited about it. Here is the expert on climate change. He's going to be talking live. And I was
they call him the number one environmentalist in America. I've heard him refer to that.
And so, but I found that he wasn't talking about animal agriculture either. And he focused on coal, and he talked about tar sands, and he talked about oil, and he talked about the Keystone Pipeline. And I remember him saying that if Keystone goes through, our environment is done for. And he also said that unless something drastic happens, humans as a species have 16 years left. So I was righteously upset about that. And afterwards, I buttonholed him and asked him, Why hadn't he talked about animal agriculture and climate change? Why didn't they just ask people to go vegan or at least vegetarian? It would be so easy and it would be so quick. And he became actually agitated, not at that situation, but agitated at me. And he asked me very pointedly, if I knew where the biggest increases in meat consumption were coming from. And I said, yes, of course I know it's coming from developing countries. And he said, very starkly, he said, how can we, as people in these countries who are just now being able to afford and enjoy meat, how can we ask them to not do it?
Leslie Goldberg will continue our discussion next week on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linton. Radio with Bob Linden at GoVeganRadio.com, on Twitter at GoVeganRadio, Facebook, GoVeganRadio with Bob Linden, a couple of Bob Linden pages there to confuse you and make me do everything in triplicate and quadruplicate. And Leslie Goldberg will return next week. I'm sure she has a lot more to say about the Sierra Club and animal agriculture and Bill McKibben, Fibbin Bill McKibben, and her confrontation with him and the executive director of the Sierra Club, Michael Brune. So Leslie Goldberg will be back next week. She's the blogger, Vicious Vegan. And all of us vicious vegans are going to gather together March 2021 and 22 and figure out just how we help the world go vegan in spite of the animal advocacy groups and environmental groups out there, all influenced by rancher money. And you'll say hi to the folks from Nature's Flavors when you're there. Go to the website, naturesflavors.com. Add some flavor to your cooking with Nature's Flavors. Many of the products available at Viva La Vegan Grocery, Rancho Cucamonga, and Santa Monica. VivaLaVeganGrocery.com. And now it is time for Animal Rights Commentary with Professor Gary Francione, the first academic to teach animal rights theory in an American law school. His website is abolitionistapproach.com. Welcome, Professor Francione. How are you today?
I'm fine. I'm having a little bit of trouble hearing you. Am I all right on your end?
I hear you just fine. So.
Great. Okay, fine. Well, Bob, I'm getting excited because the conference is coming up, and I'm really looking forward to seeing a lot of folks there. I'm getting a lot of inquiries from people. They want to know what we're going to be talking about and what sorts of things they're going to learn. And I think, I think we're going to be having a couple of very, very productive and important days. But, we're coming to the end of 2014, Bob. Did you ever think that, we were going to be on this earth long enough to see 2015?
I hoped so. I hoped so.
Well, I mean, you know.
You know, but you know, I really didn't think I'd make it past 47 because my father died of a fatal heart attack, like, at that age. So I thought, well,
did he really?
Okay.
Did he really?
Yeah, yeah, boom.
But, you know, but it's 2014, and next year, you know, we're going to see. This is the last show of this year, and I think it's important for people to focus on, you know, we all make New Year's resolutions. Well, let's make them for the animals this year. Let's resolve to make our resolutions for the animals. And I'd like to just offer some thoughts on that. First of all, if you're not vegan, I'm not talking to you, Bob. I'm talking to those people in the listening audience. If you're not vegan, you know, you're almost vegan, or you're thinking about going vegan or whatever, go vegan. You know, let that be your New Year's resolution, except don't wait until New Year's. Do it right now. You know, I think it's really important for people to understand veganism is not the ultimate goal of the movement. It is the only legitimate goal of the movement. Veganism is not what you do when you come to the end of the road in terms of, you know, your achievements for the animals. It's the first thing you do. Once you embrace or accept the idea that animals have moral significance, you go vegan. That's just what you do. You stop eating them, wearing them, using them. That just ends. I mean, once you decide that they're not things, once you agree, it's a binary world. They're either things or they're not things. If they're not things, then you have a moral obligation that you owe directly to them. If they're non-human persons and they're not things, then you have a moral obligation you owe directly to them to stop eating them, wearing them, using them, exploiting them, treating them as things, treating them as resources, treating them as property. So if you're not vegan, go vegan. And let that be your New Year's resolution. As I said before, except don't wait until New Year's. Do it right now. And just stop participating in the exploitation of non-human animals. Because if you're not vegan, that's what you're doing. Again, however, you know, good your intentions are, however much you think you love animals and whatnot, the bottom line is, if you're not vegan, you're participating directly in the exploitation of non-human animals. So just stop it. And don't worry about what you're giving up. Because, first of all, you can only legitimately sacrifice that which is yours to give up. That which is yours to sacrifice. You don't have a right to be exploiting these animals in the first place. So there's no legit, you know, it's not really a question of worrying about what you're giving up. You have no right to it in the first place. But not only is that the case, that you never had a right to it in the first place, but don't focus on the things that you lose. Think about the things that you gain. Think about the fact that you'll have some integrity because you say you care about animals. You might even have non-human companions in your house that you love, while on the other hand, you're continuing to exploit others. So just, you know, don't worry about what you're losing. Think about what you're going to gain, the fact that you're no longer participating in an essentially unjust and corrupt institutional exploitation of non-human animals. Just stop it, and you'll be gaining an enormous amount of inner peace when your actions become consistent with what you believe in your heart. What you gain is inestimable in terms of, you know, what you're quote giving up, end quote. So go vegan if you're not vegan. Resolve to educate yourself. Resolve to educate yourself about, you know, you don't have to go get a PhD in philosophy. That's not necessary. What you need to do is to learn some of the basics. That's the whole point of the Abolitionist Approach webpage. We have lots of resources free for you to come. You know, there are blog essays, there are pamphlets, there are all sorts of resources that are no cost to you. Come over to abolitionistapproach.com. Or go to the Abolitionist Approach to Animal Rights Facebook page and learn about abolitionist vegan advocacy. Educate yourself about the basics. Again, you don't have to get a higher degree. You don't have to pay any money. What you have to do is be willing to put down down some of your time, you know, so instead of playing video games or watching a movie, you know, give up a little bit of that recreational time and educate yourself. If this is important to you, the least that you can do is educate yourself about the distinction between rights and welfare, why animal welfare regulation doesn't work, why vegetarianism is an incoherent moral position. There's no moral distinction between meat and other animal foods. I mean, there is. I mean, there's no morally coherent distinction between meat and dairy. Animals used for dairy or for eggs are generally kept alive longer than animals used for meat. They're all treated hideously, and they all end up in the same slaughterhouse. So, you know, I mean, you know, educate yourself about the basics. Educate yourself about the basics. Again, you don't need sophisticated training in academia. What you need is willingness to sit down and discipline yourself and learn the basics so that you can talk to people. And then, resolution number three. Resolution number one, go vegan if you're not vegan already. Resolution number two, educate yourself about the basics on abolitionist veganism as to why people need to go vegan. Not eat cage-free eggs, not eat happy meat, not take these ridiculous speciesist steps, which don't do any good anyway, but go vegan. Why that is a moral imperative.
And Prop 2 comes into effect now in California. Who even knows what that means?
Exactly. Yeah, I know. I mean, isn't that, you know, what's really hideous about things like Proposition 2, there was I posted on my Facebook page news article from the L.A. Times, and it was basically just the smuggest, most self-satisfied story about how wonderful the people of California were because they were really ahead of the curve because they're going to have enriched cage eggs available to them. And you know, I mean, look, I don't care whether it's enriched cage eggs or cage-free eggs or anything like that. It is unjust. It is morally wrong. It involves suffering. It involves death. So this idea that, you know, that the people of California are doing such a great thing because instead of torturing the birds in conventional cages, they're going to be torturing them in enriched cages, that is just nonsense. And that is exactly why these measures are useless. Indeed, I wish I could say that they were useless. They're not useless. They're actually worse than useless. They're counterproductive because they encourage people to believe that there's a compassionate way to commit profound, fundamental injustice.
See, the word enriched, right? I mean, sometimes they're called modified or furnished, you know, but enriched, well, how can you go wrong with enriched, right?
Yeah, so. I mean, it's appalling. You know, and then when they talk about cage-free barn, a cage-free barn is one big cage. That's all it is. Mm-hmm. You know, the animals are still defecating on each other, pecking at each other. They're still in overcrowded conditions. It's still hideous for them. So this idea that, well, cage-free eggs is this, you know, is this great step, you know, in the direction of compassion or something, that is Orwellian propaganda. There is no compassionate way to do it. What is an inherently non-compassionate, unjust act of exploiting vulnerable non-humans. There's no right way to do the wrong thing. Try as you may, there is no way, there is no right, compassionate way to do the wrong, unjust, essentially non-compassionate thing. And so educate yourself about why this is the case. So it's not just a question of you having feelings about it or being emotional. Be able to discuss it with other people. That is what you owe to the animals. As difficult as that may be to sort of discipline yourself, sit down and take a few hours, you know, plan out an educational program. The International Vegan Association has reading groups for those people who want to get deeper into it. There are resources available. Take advantage, and they're free. It's not going to cost you anything except your time. So take your time, educate yourself. And then the third resolution I'd like you to consider making is that you will resolve every day to talk to one person about veganism. Now you can say, well, wait, gee, every day that's going to be rather difficult. Well, you know, if you're a hermit, maybe it will be. If you're not, it won't be difficult at all. Because
hold that thought, because we have to take a break. We'll continue with Professor Gary Francione and our New Year's resolutions for the animals on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden at goveganradio.com. Radio with Bob Linden at goveganradio.com, on Twitter at goveganradio, Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden on Facebook. My New Year's resolution is to organize the World Vegan Summit and Expo, and I hope that you resolve to be there too. You can register right now by going to worldvegansummit.com, where you will meet Professor Gary Francione, who is also offering New Year's resolutions right now. Where are we, Professor Francione?
Well, first of all, I want to endorse your resolution that everyone resolve to be at the World Vegan Summit. But I'm just talking now about the sort of the more mundane resolutions that people will make for this coming week.
Like go vegan and stay vegan.
go vegan, stay vegan. Go vegan, stay vegan. Educate yourself about the basics, about why veganism is not only not extreme, but follows from what we say we believe about animals, and is not extreme at all. What's extreme is that we say we love animals, we say that we care about animals, while we exploit billions of them every year. That's what's extreme. That's what's pathological. What veganism is not at all an extreme thing. Educate yourself. And the third thing is resolve every day to talk with people, with at least one person, about veganism. And I was saying before the break, people are going to hear that and say, well, you know, that's really impossible. You can do that because you're a professor. And the answer is, look, I've got great advantage. I mean, I teach this stuff. I'm lecturing all over the place and talking about this. So I have all sorts of opportunities to talk to groups of people and not just one person. On the other hand, we all have opportunities to talk to you know, smaller groups or to, you know, to our groups of our friends or whatnot, but to individuals. You know, yesterday I was in a grocery store and I was getting some things. And the person in front of me, or the person in back of me, actually had put, I had my stuff on the belt, and it was moving forward, and she put some chicken or something on the belt, and I said to the checkout guy, I said, that stuff's not mine. I said, I wouldn't want dead flesh to show up on my receipt. And he laughed and he said, are you a vegetarian? And I said, no, I'm a vegan. And he said, well, you know, he said, I used to be a vegetarian. And I said, you know, we got into a discussion, much to the consternation of the person in back of me, because he was really not paying much attention. And we were involved in a conversation about the fact that he was a vegetarian and was no longer a vegetarian. And I was telling him, look, he needed to just go vegan. And he was saying, you know, he really cared about animals, and he was really horrified about what the way people treated animals and factory farming. You know, I said to him, look, factory farming, I said, the fact that you object to factory farming means that you think that animals have moral value and that we ought not to exploit them in that way. And he said, well, that's right. And I said, well, then what the hell difference does it make if the factory farm, family farm, whether it's the Taj Mahal, what difference does it make whether the animals are tortured a lot or whether they're subjected to less distress and suffering and the same death? I said, the bottom line is the subjection to factory farming is nonsense, because, you know, you object to factory farming, great, but that means you think animals have moral value, and if you think animals have moral value, the solution, the response is to go vegan, not to buy happy meat, or not to say, oh, I want to buy animals that have been raised and slaughtered on a family farm. You know, I mean, this way of thinking, this constant obsession we have to try to find right ways to do the wrong thing, just complete nonsense. Mm-hmm. And so every single one of us has an opportunity every single day to have a conversation with someone about veganism, and resolve, please, to do that. And when you have that conversation, engage people. Assume that they're, if they're taking the time to talk to you, that they're engaging with you in good faith, and engage them in a creative, nonviolent, non-hostile way. You can be strong. You can be unequivocal. You know, you can be unequivocal. You ought to be unequivocal. But always engage them in a creative, nonviolent way. And I want to wish everybody and my good friend Bob Linden a wonderful 2015. Let's make it a great year. And let's all of us try to meet at the World Vegan Summit in March. Let's all of us make it a good year and hope that it's a good year, not just for ourselves, but let's think about the non-human others who are being slaughtered by the billions out there. Let's try to make it a better year for them. But the only way we're ever going to succeed in doing that is by shifting the paradigm, not by staying in the same paradigm of animals as things, and we're going to do it better. We're going to exploit better. We're going to be more humane. We're going to be more compassionate. That's nonsense.
No, we're going to do it best. We're going to do it best. We're going to go vegan.
Exactly. We're going to do it best.
Happy New Year. Happy New Year. And we'll talk again next year, Professor Francio.
Next year, Bob.
Okay.